call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon State Legislature. It's Wednesday, February 7th, 2007. Today we'll be having a public hearing on House Bill 2403 and House Bill 2498. But before that, we're going to introduce some committee bills. So at this time, I'd like to open a work session. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I would like to move that the committee adopt LC 2645, 2646, 2647, 2648, 2649, and 2650 as committee bills.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici moves that we adopt LC 2645, 2646, 2647, 2648, 2649, and 2650 as House Consumer Protection Committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing no objection, those bills are so adopted. At this time, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2403. Steve, would you give us a brief summary of House Bill 2403?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2403 requires that Construction Contractors Board send claimant notice of available methods for collecting amounts due under unpaid final order.
Thank you. If we could have a representative from the Representative Schaffler is not here, but Amanda Rich, perhaps, come forward.
Good afternoon,
Amanda. If you could identify yourself for the record and who you're representing today, that would be great.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I'm representing today Contractors Bonding and Insurance Company, also known as CBIC. So if you hear that acronym, that's what that means. We are bringing forward today House Bill 2403, which is we consider is a little piece that might be a good fix to part of this concern over unpaid contractor debt. By way of background, CBIC is the largest underwriter of contractor surety bonds in Oregon. Right now we're providing bonds to approximately 13,000 contractors in Oregon. And contractors and residential construction, represent the sole focus of our company's operations. We took part in the construction claims task force in 05 and 06, and we're very involved with the discussions that went on in that task force. And we think that, as I mentioned earlier, that 2403 is a little piece to the larger picture and the many little pieces of solutions you're going to be looking at to address that issue. Specifically, what we're looking at is a situation where a claimant has received a final order on a claim that they made against a contractor through the CCB process. They get their final order, and let's say, for example, that the final order is $32,000 that is owed to them. The contractor has a bond for $15,000. So there's that excess of $17,000. And that is, the excess has been some, it has been a subject of some discussion. And the question is, does that $17,000 ever get paid, and do we know about it? And there are ways that the consumer can pursue that excess $17,000 in debt, and in particular, that final order from CCB acts as a judgment that can be entered with the county clerk and can be brought as a lien against the contractor property. And so that it can be a very strong lever in pursuing the remainder of that debt. And our concern was that consumers did not know that they were receiving. And I have for you, if you'd like to see, I have for you an example of an order that gets sent to the claimant. And there's just one or two sentences about the legal process that they're involved in, about what they can do with their order. And it doesn't have a full explanation of the legal ramifications of that order and what a tool it can be for them in pursuing the remainder of their debt that might, again, remain after the bond is paid out. So we brought this bill as a way of ensuring that the claimant gets notice of what they can do, the steps that they can take on their unpaid final order. And we think, again, it's a good piece of this larger puzzle of trying to deal with consumer protection in the construction defect arena. That will conclude my testimony. I'd love to answer questions if you have any.
We have questions from the committee at this point. Amanda, before you step down, you know I had this discussion with you yesterday, and
yes.
If you wouldn't mind staying there, I'd like to have the Construction Contractors Board come up so I can kind of get their take on this.
Absolutely.
And maybe I have a question about the information on this form. Sorry to catch you off guard here, Craig, but if you could state your name for the record, please.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I did my best to stay as small as I could back here. It didn't work out. but I am passing out a couple of documents here. Craig Smith with the Construction Contractors Board. We brought these just in case you might have asked me to come up and talk about this a little bit. So we had this in our back pocket. The Construction Contractors Board, as you know, has a process wherein we think of it as a court case almost, where people can almost sue a contractor through our process. And we're able to mediate, as I've told you before, about half of those matters, get them off the deck before there's any adversarial dispute resolution. But unfortunately, in some cases, that doesn't work, and we're obligated to go into a hearing process. And in some cases, we find that the contractor owes money to the claimant. And in many cases, that's a homeowner. And when that occurs, we issue a proposed order. That proposed order will become final after a certain operational period of time. And we then start down this process of what you might think of as the collections process. Because the first thing we're looking at is if there has been no timely appeal to the order, then we consider it owed to the claimant. And we will then notify the claimant. Now, if I can, I'll walk you through this little several-page document that I have here. The first page is the document that's entitled Proposed Default Order and Notice of Opportunity for a Hearing. Gives you an idea of what goes out as a proposed order. And in this case, there was a order to pay the claimant. In this case, the claimant appears to be a homeowner, some $8,500 or so. So that goes out, and then we wait and see if there's a request for a hearing. If there is none, then the next document goes out. That's the one that's page number, or it's not page number. It's November 15th, 06 at the top. It's not very much material in it. And it indicates that we did not receive a timely request for a hearing. And therefore, our proposed and final order has become final as of a particular date pursuant to a certain rule. And the respondent has 30 days from that date to pay you. So then we start the clock. And we start watching to see if the contractor pays. Shortly thereafter, 1 month later, you see we send another document to the claimant, asking the claimant if they've been paid or not. Because obviously if they've been paid, that stops the process. If they haven't, then we consider sending the matter to the bonding company. We also start looking at whether or not we should be taking that contractor's license away and some other disciplinary issues. We then, in this particular case, the next document that you see in here is what goes to the bonding company, conditioned on us receiving back from the claimant that statement that they had not been paid. And, of course, sometimes we get a statement from the claimant saying they've been paid and a statement from the contractor saying, well, no, wait a minute, I paid them. We have to work that out if that's the kind of conflict that we receive. But in this case, we didn't receive that conflict, so we send an order to the bonding company to pay the debt. And we also send, in this case, about a month thereafter, the document that is a letter to the claimant telling them what's going on. And that's the one that's dated February 6, 07. We think it's probably at this point where providing the information that CBIC is suggesting would be appropriate. And we currently provide some of this information today. And I think that in a perfect world, the kind of notice that they have might be very nice. I mean, it's a good way to do it. But we wanted both CBIC and for you to know that we're currently doing something like that. The other document that I've given you is a memo from Mr. Boyd to me, and he wanted me to share with you that we'd like to be able to work with CBIC, perhaps between now and the next time you bring this matter up, perhaps we could work this out without having to have a statutory change. Or if that doesn't work out, perhaps we could have a statutory change that requires us to do this by rule. So if circumstances change a couple years down the road and both the bonding companies and the state think there's some other notice ought to be there, we could make that other notice available. That would conclude my testimony.
Thank you. Do we have questions, Mr. Smith? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Rich and Mr. Smith, and either of you can answer this question, I hope. I just want a little clarification on the timing, because it looks like the letter, the February 6th letter that you think might be the place where this notice would go out came after a series of other things, and I'm not clear on whether the notice in House Bill 2403, I'm not clear on when that goes out to the consumer.
Our thought, Chair Holvey, Representative Bonamici, our thought was that it would go out actually with the final order, so that it would be accompanying that, so they would understand, again, the legal ramifications and what they could do with that order. But I understand what Director Smith is saying is that you might want to wait until knowing if the contractor has agreed to pay on the claim before a person goes jumping around and getting a lien on their property. So there would be a proper timing to it. But, again, I think that folks need to understand the legal effect of that order.
And to dovetail into that, what staff has told me this afternoon as I was preparing for this is that in some cases the bond has already been tapped. The proposed order is about the 10th person down the line. We know there's nothing there, and we send this information out very early because we know that the consumer is going to want to get started with its collection process against the assets of the company.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have the suggestion then that there needs to be some sort of clarification, because the way it's drafted, that it says if the construction contractor's board final order is not paid by the contractor, the board shall send the notice to the claimant. So there seems to be a time lag between the order and the notice that I think needs to get clarified. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for being here. I'm just curious, who determined that attorney's fees and at all costs would not exceed $3,000, which is a kind of seems like an arbitrary number, depending on the size of this issue? I can certainly see that being a much higher fee. Page 2, sure. Line 43, 44.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, that is language that's in existing statutes. I'm afraid I'd have to defer to Director Smith on that. payments from the bond.
Okay.
Yes. I think Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, it would be more efficient if I can get back to you on that. Let me give you a kind of preliminary answer just in case I have this right without fully reviewing this. We do have access to the bond is limited for non-owners. So non-owners only have access to a portion of the bond. If it's a $15,000 bond, it's $3,000. And that probably is what that's referring to, but I'll double-check that, and if I can, I'll get right back to you.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? I just have one that I've shared with Amanda earlier on this, and, I guess this is pointed more at the CCB if they were to adopt a form like this. One of my concerns in this is that it kind of puts the board in the position of providing legal advice perhaps to a claimant, and I guess my concern would be that in doing so, if you were to leave out any of the different avenues somebody could pursue, or if there was something that was left out of this, it seemed like you should have some sort of disclaimer on a form like this saying, that you're not an attorney and they should seek legal advice to answer some of those questions. It seemed like it might put the agency itself in some sort of liability scenario in my mind. Maybe that's not true, but that was just one of my concerns of this bill, and I don't know if you can comment to that now or make me rest assured at a later date.
Chair Holvey, I think, first of all, I agree with your observation that it's vital that the agency not be giving legal advice. If we're just restating what's in statute, we probably would not be. So, if you determine that it's something that ought to be in the statute, we could probably do that without providing legal advice. But I agree with you. It's something that we fight every day when we're trying to answer questions from consumers about various aspects of our program or problems with contractors. How do we provide them with a fair amount of information without crossing the line and providing legal advice? It's a tough task.
Chair Holvey, we would agree that, and I think it would be perfectly reasonable and correct for CCB to include a disclaimer. One of the nice things about the CCB process is that a claimant can enter it without an attorney, and frequently it's simple and they can navigate the process on their own. But certainly when it gets complicated or if it gets to this point, I think that they probably should be advised.
So, and having that said, I wonder if the contractor's bonding insurance company or you can work with Craig on this to see if you can come to some sort of agreement. I kind of like the concept that's involved here. I think it does perhaps serve a pretty good purpose, and I know the CCB's got a number of forms and that they provide notices and things like that, but maybe you can work together and let me know if there's something that can be agreed on to achieve this concept, and then whether or not it needs legislative action or not.
That would be our pleasure.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Just one quick question, please. How does a claimant get a list of all the real property that the contractor owns? I mean, and I even see in this one where you can go across lines, county lines, I'm guessing state lines, too.
Chair Holvey and Representative Nelson, it's a very good question. It's not an easy process. This is a collections issue that is best handled by a professional in the field. I can tell you I've never done it, never had to do it, but if I did, I would go talk to my lawyer and say, look, I've got a significant debt I need to collect. Help me with the process of filing these matters in court. And, of course, that's As my colleague points out in our letter, I should have pointed that to you, we do suggest in the February 6th letter that individuals talk to an attorney for more information.
Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, and sorry I didn't prepare you for coming up and speaking, Craig, ahead of time. I guess it was sort of a thought that I didn't really... I'm glad you were prepared for it, though.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2403 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2498. Steve, would you give us a brief overview?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2498 permits transference of unexercised right of claim for negligent or improper work against the contractor on existing structure from seller to purchaser. The measure extends construction contractor licensing exemptions to an owner in the business of reselling a structure if the owner hires a licensed contractor.
Thank you. It's time. I'd like to have Harlan Levy come forward. And anybody else that would like to join him?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I am Harlan Levy, here representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, here to support House Bill 2498. We appreciate this opportunity to be here today to present this bill to you. House Bill 2498 deals with the situation where you have people that buy existing homes, then hire licensed contractors to fix those homes up and then put those homes back onto the market. These individuals are providing substantial benefit to the consumers of residential housing by using their capital to improve the quality of existing housing. This adds curb appeal to the homes in existing neighborhoods and can, in fact, improve the quality and the property values of the homes in close proximity to the home that they are purchasing. The problem is, under current law, we have a definition of contractor in ORS 701.005 sub 3, which includes these people. According to the statute, anybody who, quote, arranges for work to be done on an existing home is considered to be a contractor, even if this person does not lift a single hammer, does not hammer a single nail, and all the work that is being done, that they are arranging for to be done, is being done by licensed contractors. Many people out there do not know this is the status of current law and are engaging in this activity without knowledge that they could, in fact, be engaging in an unlawful practice. This is a problem. There are several exceptions to the contractor licensing requirements in current law. And the one exception that we deal with in this bill is the current exception for the existing owner of the property. Right now, if you own the property, you are allowed to arrange for repairs to be made by other licensed contractors if you're not licensed. However, the statute requires that you occupy the property. So the existing exemption deals for homeowners, for people that you know, want to do a kitchen remodel in their house. And hire a licensed contractor to do it. I mean, it makes sense. What our bill proposes to do is to extend this exemption to allow for people that are not living in the house but still own the house, the homeowner, to arrange for work to be done by licensed contractors and then be able to take that remodel, the remodeled house, and put it back onto the market for sale. This is a very limited, and I want to stress that, this is a very limited expansion of the existing exception. We are not going to be allowing the owners to do the work themselves. We are not going to be allowing for anybody to be doing the work other than licensed contractors. This is what we think a common sense expansion of the existing exemption. This should allow for more, well, in my testimony I talk about how this is going to increase the supply of rehabilitated and renovated houses, which provides a public benefit for people. When people are buying these homes, they may not have the capital they need to go ahead and pay for the repairs after they acquire the property. This allows for that to be done on the seller side, and that they're buying basically a rehabilitated home. What we've done in this bill is we were concerned with protecting the home buyer. Consumer protection is very important to my members. So if you look at the bill, we have the way legislative council drafted it, they kind of drafted it backwards. It wasn't the way I submitted it, but it does what we want it to do. Section 2 of the bill talks about transferring an unexercised claim to the buyer. And this is what we're talking about. This will protect a home buyer so that if the work were to be done either negligently or improperly, that buyer would have recourse to the CCB. They would be able to file a CCB claim and go after the contractor that did the negligent work. That does not exist under current law. So right now, buyers of these homes are unprotected. And like I said, this activity, we know that it's occurring. So those buyers are out there potentially without any recourse against a negligent contractor. Our bill extends the ability for them to file a claim. It doesn't go any further than what the seller would have, but it's a pretty significant change, and we think it will do a very good job of protecting the consumer. I also want to note that the way the industry practice these days is for most buyers to get a home inspection done as well. You know, the real estate form that most realtors use provides a home inspection contingency that allows for the buyer to, at their expense, have a home inspection done, and that also allows them to, based on the results of that home inspection, walk away from the deal if they want. We highly recommend that our members recommend to their clients that they do take advantage of getting a home inspection. So we do have a lot of protection out there for the home buyer. Finally, I just wanted to note that what we have now, we think, is overregulation in the marketplace, and that's not good for the market. You know, you have what is basically an entry barrier for people that want to do good things. They want to go in there. They want to fix up these homes. They want to, you know, rehabilitate housing inventory, put it back on the market, and sell it. And we don't think that it's good public policy for the state to be discouraging that. So we would hope that this committee favorably considers this bill and ends up moving it eventually into a work session into the floor with a due pass recommendation. I do want to add that I've been talking with Mr. Scott Berry from the Home Builders about this. Unfortunately, he's unable to be here today. I will have a meeting. I have a meeting scheduled with him next week. We're going to talk about this bill. They have, and the home builders have some concerns. I think we can alleviate those concerns. They would probably like to see a general contractor be part of the requirements here. I don't think that would be a problem for us as well. So, you know, hopefully when we come back in front of you, we will have a bill that we can all agree to and basically sing kumbaya in front of the committee. With that, I am concluding my testimony and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I just want to hear you sing kumbaya.
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, I really think
he's out of order.
Yeah, I didn't approve of that that line of questioning either. Any questions from the committee of Mr. Levy? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for being here, gentlemen. Harlan, why is this just applicable to one home? I think it's where I read that somewhere. One. Yeah, just applies to the first purchaser of a structure. So, because, you know, I might be gone in a day or two after this stuff is done and.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, what we're talking about here is the unexercised construction contractors board claim. We wanted to cut off liability at some point, and what we thought was fair was that the first buyer would be able to use an unexercised claim for negligent work. If that buyer then turns around and were to sell it to a subsequent buyer, they would not be able to step into the shoes of filing a CCB claim. But I would note that under current law, you only have 1 year anyway from substantial completion of the work in order to file a CCB claim. So, you know, sure, it could happen where, you know, one buyer would transfer it to another buyer within that year's time. I think it's unlikely. And furthermore, remember, you do have common law misrepresentation claims still available. So if, you know, in a circumstance where if you know, buyer number one were to, you know, purchase the property and let's say the roof leaked, and that buyer chose to sell it to buyer number two, knowing that the roof was leaking and didn't disclose that fact, buyer number two would have a cause of action for misrepresentation and failure to disclose a material fact against buyer number one. What buyer number two would not have, and you're correct, is they would not be able to go against the contractor that installed that roof.
Follow up, please, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, please.
Would you be willing to change this to whoever the owner was for one full year since the work was done?
Representative Holvey, or Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, I don't see a problem with doing that. I would want to talk to, you know, the home builders and the contractors before we did that, because you could be opening up more potential liability for them. But, yeah, for purposes of consumer protection, I wouldn't see a problem with that.
Representative Riley.
Yeah, I have a real question. Can you tell me, this says existing residential structure. We've been talking about it as if it were a house. But residential structures, does that include other structures? Does that include a condominium complex?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, I believe the definition of residential structure pertains to up to four units. So if it's four units or less, then it could apply to condominiums, but not a condominium building of hundreds of units. We wanted this bill to be pretty narrow. We think we want to make sure that we're not going too far too fast. So the idea was existing houses, mostly.
Follow up, please.
And if that was the intent, single-family dwellings was the intent, I believe, if I'm right about that, why don't we just say that?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, we could say that, and I think that an amendment to define that would be fine as far as we were concerned. I mean, the idea is existing houses and residential neighborhoods.
Thank you.
I have a follow up to that. It would just the definition of existing, I guess, as opposed to new. Is there a time limit which defines the difference between existing and new?
Chair Holden, Representative Riley, I don't believe there is. I think existing inventory means it's a house that's got four walls and a roof. I don't know that. It has to have been on the ground for a certain period of time.
So by your definition, it could be a new house then.
Well, Mr. Chair, this bill is not intended to allow for people to construct new houses. It's intended for people to be able to rehabilitate existing houses. And if we need to deal with that in the bill and specify that, we would be happy to do that.
Okay.
I did want to add one thing before I forget. I have attached some testimony from Craig and Sherry Klein to my testimony. They were unable to be here. They are realtors who support the bill. I just wanted to put that in the record as well.
Thank you. Other questions of Mr. Levy? If not, I assume Lois Streeter?
Yes.
Is here to testify as well. So if you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Lloyd Streeter. I represent Geisen Realty Company. I've been a broker for 35 years, hold broker's license in New York State, California, and also in Oregon. It has been my experience over many, many years that very often there is substantial work that has to be done on a property that's being sold. The homeowner, or the potential buyer, rather, has an inspection. The inspection comes back and says, for example, that the house needs some new plumbing. It needs a new roof. Those repairs are negotiated out between the potential buyer and the seller, and then the seller goes ahead and does the work. Under the current law, when the buyer moves in, if the roof leaks like a sieve, he's unable to do anything about it. Now, if you go out, any of you, you buy a brand new car and it has a 100,000-mile warranty from the manufacturer, when you sell that car with 50,000 miles, that warranty is transferred on to the next buyer. I see no reason that the same warranty shouldn't pass on to the buyer of the house, whether it's replacing plumbing, replacing a new roof, or whatever it is. It's just simple logic. Why should the contractor be let off the hook after 2 weeks, after he puts a new roof on, simply because the property has changed hands? It's just unreasonable. And so the bill here it's proposed is to correct this shortcoming and say that the warranty, whatever it might be, should be fully transferable to the new buyer. Now, further, in the case of, you say you limit it to 1 year, but there could be roofing problems that would not show up for 2 or 3 years. If the plywood starts delaminating, for example, that is not going to show up right away. That may not show up for 2 or 3 years, and all of a sudden it's leaking, and you go back and say, hey, the new roof was put on this house 3 years ago. Who do I have recourse against? Nobody. I'm stuck. So, I mean, this just isn't right, and it really needs to be corrected.
Thank you, Mr. Streeter. Questions of Mr. Streeter from the committee? Seeing none, next up, Bruce Cuff.
Yeah, I'm Representative Chair. I'm Bruce Cuff, and I'm a realtor here in Salem with Prudential Real Estate, and I'm just representing myself today. And one of the things that I see that this bill does is it brings kind of a common sense back to the part of the market that there's people out there who live in neighborhoods and there's an eyesore in the neighborhood that comes for sale on the market and they'd like to purchase that and fix it up and resell it. And as a realtor, I have these conversations with potential buyers that I have to say, you know, you'd like to buy that, fix it up, and resell it. However, you can't do that unless you have a contractor's license. And they say, oh, you know, I'm only going to clean it up inside out, maybe do some painting, but any repair work, I'll hire a contractor. And then I have to explain to them, no, sir. That's not the way the law is written. If you buy it with the intent to resell it, you must have a contractor's license if you're going to engage in that activity. And to try to explain that to somebody time and time again, I mean, it just makes no common sense. And I think there's a lot of houses out there that there's a market for people to buy and, you know, do one or two a year as a real estate investment where they do hire contractors, get the work done, and then resell it. And I think it's a benefit to the community to get those fixed up. And without that, I mean, there's people out there that don't know the law. And as a realtor, I'm constantly explaining that to people and, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. And this bill would bring a common sense back to that, to where with that transferability, the consumer, the buyer, would still be protected if, you know, when he used the contractor. You know, like Harlan was saying, right now, if they operate outside the law and they hire contractors, that contract is only with that contractor. As soon as they sell that house, the buyer has no recourse. And this fixes that problem and also removes the requirement for that small-time real estate investor to actually have to have a real estate license, because the costs are pretty prohibitive for him to do that. So, and that concludes my testimony. If you have any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Harlan, before I let you off the hook, I do have a question, I guess, for you. On page 2 of this bill, we've talked about a lot about how this applies, and Section 4 even says this applies to residential structure sales. But on page 2, it's included in this bill is commercial structure or new residential structure. Can you elaborate what the implication of adding commercial structure in there is?
Sure. Chair Holvey, this bill isn't written the way that I spent. I can tell you that. However, it does do what we want it to do. What Legislative Council did by adding those words in there was they basically added an exemption to the exemption to the exemption. Now, let me explain what that means. Okay. If you look...
Sorry, I asked.
No, this is getting great.
I like this. If you look at the first sentence... in subsection 5, on line 2 of page 2, that provides you with the exemption from the need to be a licensed contractor if you are an owner. And then the next sentence modifies that exemption that says that exemption for owners does not apply if you have the intent to sell the structure. What we've done in the next clause, where we've added those new, where Legislative Council added those new words, has said, but if you're arranging for the work to be done for something other than a commercial structure or a new residential structure, meaning an existing residential structure, then that exemption does apply. So again, it's an exemption to the exemption to the exemption. So it does give you the ability to engage in this practice without a contractor's license, so long as all you're doing is arranging for the work to be done by a contractor on something other than a commercial structure or a new residential structure. Again, I didn't write it that way, but it does do what we had intended.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to suggest, after having read that about 6 times, that if there are any amendments, that be clarified, because it is very difficult, and I think it will be a better bill if it's flipped back around so that the exemption is the exemption rather than the exception to the exemption of the exemption. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, thank you. The way I wrote it, it was its own section. It was its own exemption. It was a new subsection 6. However, it didn't come back that way, but I will let Legislative Council know that that would be the desire of
by
this community.
Representative.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if this would constitute English under Representative Nelson's bill.
I think we should specify that.
All right.
Senor.
Representative Garrod.
Thank you, Chair. This is for Bruce Cuff. I want to welcome you here. He's a member of my district. And the question I would have is, it seems like this bill would have a lot of advantages in other areas. For example, in blighted areas, it would make it more easily to repair certain areas, and do you see an advantage in that sort of arena?
Yes, Chair and Representative Gerard. A lot of times the people that are interested in fixing up property are the ones who live in the neighborhood, and, you know, so they see something come for sale or they go after something that's run down and they say, well, you know, that would be a good investment. And me as a realtor, they'll call me up and say, hey, there's a run down house in my neighborhood. Can you find out who owns that and see if they'd be willing to sell it? And when I find out what their intent is to buy it, fix it up, and resell it, then I have this conversation with them about how they got to have a contractor's license to do that. And so all of a sudden, the idea of getting that house in the neighborhood, getting it fixed up, you know, because it's affecting their property values, all of a sudden they back way off and say, oh, well, you know, geez, that just seems like a lot to go through just to, you know, get this. And it's not a friendly, not friendly for that, you know, for just normal type homeowner people that want to fix something up in their neighborhood, they can't do it. And if they do engage in doing it, and then, you know, basically outside the law and go ahead and fix it up and resell it, the buyer that purchases that right now has no recourse with the contractors who did, if he did hire contractors to do with the work, the buyer has no recourse right now to get any compensation if the work wasn't done properly. So this bill transfers that right to the buyer and allows that homeowner to do that. So it makes sense. So
Representative Nelson, another question?
I wasn't even listening.
I got it.
Okay, good. Mr. Chair, Harlan, what if this contractor doesn't have anything? What am I going to do? He didn't have any money. I mean, I need help because this is a very bad Louisiana Pacific siding and my house is falling down or something.
Chair Holvey, Representative Nelson, you know, we're trying to work within the parameters of the existing CCB requirements, and presumably the contractor is going to at least have a bond, at least have insurance. And you're right, there are situations where when they've got numerous claimants, that gets eaten up real fast. You know, I'd love to be able to solve all the problems in this bill, but, you know, we're trying to focus on this one problem. And, you know, they would have the potential to go after the seller for material facts, failure to disclose a material fact in that, you know, the siding is defective or whatever. So there's always that recourse under the common law. But again, we wanted to work within the existing CCB structure on this bill.
Thank you. And for the record, not all LP Louisiana Pacific products are bad.
Absolutely not.
So.
I was just thinking that one siding.
So if no further questions from the committee of these gentlemen, I'd like to give the opportunity for the Construction Contractors Board to return to the stand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I always wonder, what if he refused to?
Let's not go there.
Yeah. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, Craig Smith is my name, and if I refuse to do that, I never would.
Okay, good.
I should tell you that the Construction Contractors Board is neutral on this measure at best, because we have not had a chance to fully vet the bill, take a look at it. We have run it by our AG, and I want a chance to talk to the Construction Contractors Board members at our next meeting before we would even attempt to take a position on the bill. I can tell you this, it reminds me of something my predecessor told me about 10 years ago. I'm sure you've heard this, but he was telling me, trying to educate me about politics a little bit, and he suggested that a person that he knew ran for office indicated that in a public hearing, he said, well, half of my friends favor this particular measure. Okay. The other half of my friends oppose it, and on this very important measure, I stand squarely with my friends. And I think that's the way the board would look at this. This
that's
is
good.
A policy issue. We think that there are some consumer protection issues here that you need to worry about. We think there are also some important issues having to do with deregulation. If you can deregulate to the degree and not hurt consumers and indeed make consumer protection better, all the better. But we worry about any time you start making some significant changes, what there might be in the way of fiscal impacts. We think that there would be a little bit here because we'll have more claims, not less. Quite frankly, there are some other issues that I think that the building community may want to bring you and talk to you about them that would be better brought by them rather than me.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. I didn't really mean to put you on the spot, but I just had one question about this, and you may or may not be prepared to answer it. I'm just curious whether under this bill you see that it gives the ability to somebody to perform, an owner to perform
contracting work without a license. Construction contracting work. Let me be more specific, to actually do construction work without a license.
Chair Holder and members of the committee, the short answer is yes, but that may not be a bad thing. Indeed, you have some mini exemptions under 701.010 to the contractor licensing law. This would, in essence, broaden one of those exemptions. And it may make sense. After all, what you're talking about here is people who either own property or want to purchase the property with the ability to fix it up and arguably fix it up right, fix it up well, perhaps use licensed people. Presumably they would do everything according to good standard practices, and you'd have a great dwelling when it was over. When it was all said and done. The negative side is if you believe that licensed construction contractors have certain experiences that they bring towards rehabilitation that the average buyer of properties don't know, then one might argue that a first person buying a rundown home and trying to bring in experts to fix it up may or may not get the right experts, may or may not contract appropriately to do all the repairs appropriate, and maybe a few years down the lane, a foundation that they thought they did right wasn't done right, or maybe a roof or a room addition, who knows what. These are the arguments, again, that I think you need to listen to from the other side of this issue, and probably are inappropriate for me.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I just want to clarify for the record, especially since I notice that I've signed on to this bill, that the way I, and this might be clarified if it's amended or redrafted, the way I read it is that under this 5 exception, the owner needs to contract for work to be performed by a licensed contractor. Now, it may be that under another section that already exists, your question is concerned, but this bill, I don't think, expands the areas where an owner can do general contractor work without a license, or construction work without a license. My understanding is that this bill requires that the person who's out there buying the home to be fixed up does a contract for the work to be performed by a licensed contractor. Is Harlan back there nodding? Yes. Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Yes. Just one point about that, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who catches this, but they are performing general contract work, and the general contractor supervises other contractors, as we've heard many times. So,
I guess no comments are required from you, sir. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
And for the committee's information, we will be hearing this bill again, and the home builders will be present and providing us more testimony on this bill. And in the meantime, I hope that the realtors and the home builders can work out some of the details, because I think this bill does have some merit that this committee should look at. So. Any other comments from the committee this time? Anybody else that would wish to testify on House Bill 2498 in the audience? Seeing none, I would like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2498 and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Committee.